There are also a number of things which were known to chemists working with polyvinyl chloride at the time, which I don't think had been much written down anywhere, but just general lore. The effect of HCl, for example. If you stored a bag of polyvinyl chloride films in a warm place or in the sunlight, the bag itself was impermeable to gas. Maybe it was polyvinyl chloride. You finally opened the bag, there was a big smell of hydrochloric acid came out. The PVC had split HCl out. That was well known empirically. So I did experiments with that. I'd put a piece of polyvinyl chloride film in sealed tubes, expose them to lighter heat for a while, open them, analyze them for HCl. There's an autocatalytic effect, presumably because of the low pH generated by the HCl there, would catalyze the splitting out of more HCl. So I'd plot a rate curve, it would take off. So I spent some time examining that effect and seeing what conditions were that would bring it on. Using very simple equipment, ultraviolet light sources, some sun lamps, and a big arc light source called, I think, a weatherometer, which they had there for a lot of other studies. Tried looking at the molecular weights of PVC as it degraded, but that didn't come up with anything very interesting because we know now PVC is not completely soluble in ordinary solvents at room temperature, so that molecular weight measurements are really measuring aggregates and not individual molecules. But anyway, I was able to keep busy with lots of interesting experiments. Every once in a while, we'd have to give a report to a whole bunch of industrial people who were associated with projects. They'd all come in on Saturday morning, and we would get up and show slides of all these latest developments. And I think they were entertained and found some of it, perhaps, of some use back home.
What companies do you remember?
Union Carbide, DuPont. There were certainly two of them. U.S. Rubber. I don't remember what others, but there were a number of others, too.
And did you do any teaching, or were you strictly...
Yeah, I did a little bit of teaching. That was sort of after hours. Taught a physical chemistry course one term. I taught a course in atomic physics for chemical engineers one term.
Must have been an interesting experience.
Yeah. It was a good group, actually. One of them wrote me years later, saw my name in Chemical Engineering News in connection with something. And he said, at the time, they couldn't see what we're learning all this stuff about atoms for. And then that summer meeting afterwards, an atomic bomb had exploded, and they suddenly understood.
This continued up through the end of the war, then?
Yeah, that continued through the end of the war. I stayed there until the end of the summer of 1946.
Once the war ended, had you given any thoughts to what you were going to do beyond that point?
Well, nothing very serious. I guess I was still very much involved with that project. Actually, through Joe Mayer, I think, who is a Berkeley PhD, I got offered a job at Berkeley. So, of course, I was very happy to accept that. Mm-hmm. I didn't really have to do much looking.
And you went there when, in the fall of 40?
46.
46.
Yeah.
Let me back up for a moment. You have recounted rather thoroughly the work on light scattering that developed out of the Bayes early work, and what you and Mark and Doty published a quick paper on that. And you published a rather lengthy paper that followed.
We published the first two letters to the editor, and then we followed that with a paper in General Chemical Physics getting more details. All this must have been 44 and 45, I think. And then we had a review article and something that Mark had started called a polymer bulletin, which has no relation to the current polymer bulletin.
I guess I'm not... I was trying to get at how this led you then into... Well, you didn't do any light scattering work once you went to Brooklyn.
Some. Doty actually had the main responsibility for that, but I helped with it. Some. We had one joint student there, got a master's degree named Bill Affens, A-F-F-E-N-S, who worked on light scattering from polystyrene solutions. And we published that, too. That, I think, was in the Transactions of the Faraday Society.
But when you went to Berkeley, you picked up the light scattering work rather quickly.
Yeah, well, I had been working on it, you see. Mm-hmm. Though the other things I was... My main effort at Brooklyn Poly was this polyvinyl chloride stuff. Light scattering was one of the techniques to which we used, which I think was not very useful for polyvinyl chloride, but I was at least familiar with the technique. I also developed an osmometer while I was at Brooklyn Poly for use on the PVC. That was with a student named Meyerson, M-Y-E-R-S-O-N. So when I went to Berkeley, it was just natural to continue that work.
The first thing you did was develop a new apparatus, is that correct? That was, I think, one of your first
publications. Yeah, that was the first thing, was to build a photoelectric as opposed to a visual apparatus.
Could you tell me something about what led you into that?
We had been talking about a photoelectric apparatus at Brooklyn. And in fact, I think we had a photometer, which was sold as a complete piece of apparatus. It was called, a photovolt. Photometer. Photovolt, one word, made by, I guess, the Photovolt Corporation, but it wasn't sensitive enough. It used an ordinary phototube. What one needed for light scattering was a multiplier phototube, which had just become available. So I guess, I don't remember now for sure, I guess we talked about building such a thing at Brooklyn, and then when I went to Berkeley and found the electronics stockroom and found people with electronics expertise, it seemed like a natural thing to do. Particularly when I got a couple of graduate students who needed projects to work on.
Did those graduate students start working for you right away, did they?
Not right away. I guess they showed up in the spring of 1947.
Okay.
And I was just starting to build the apparatus at that point.
How long did that take?
Getting the apparatus, getting it working? I had a very simple version of it going in a few months, but to build a good, reliable instrument took longer, and must have taken about a year. We published results on it in 48, and I went there in 46 and didn't start building until, I'm sure, until the spring of 47, so I think it must have taken about a year to get it really going.
You also collaborated with Stockmeyer, I think around, wasn't that long after you went to Berkeley?
Yeah, it was after I went to Berkeley. We had talked about collaborating on things when I was at Brooklyn. He had left Columbia by that time and gone to MIT, but he got back to New York once in a while, and I didn't. I went up to Boston once, and I guess we corresponded some. Anyway, we talked about writing a joint paper using Mayer's statistical mechanical methods on macromolecule solutions, but actually we never got to doing it together, and I wrote it myself while I was at Brooklyn. But then we did succeed in collaborating on theory of branch polymers, and that was a paper I think we published in 49. We did that pretty much by long distance. I would write something and send it to him, and he would write stuff and send it back.
Your work is interesting to me in the sense that you're highly theoretical on one side, and yet quite practical in building a number of instruments along the way.
Well, I've always found that the two complement each other very well in a field like macromolecules, which at that time was rather undeveloped, and they needed both kinds of work. So if you could do both kinds of work, why it's good to do that.
Which did you feel more comfortable in, or did you find more satisfying?
Oh, I found both of them, I think, equally so. I always liked doing things with my hands. On the other hand, I found I also liked mathematical physics, so.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can do both, why, one leads to the other. You do an experiment, then you need to interpret it, or you start developing a theory, and then you need experiments. It's very hard for a theoretician to persuade some experimentalist to do his work for him. Not usually so hard for an experimentalist to get a theoretician to help him out if he finds an interesting phenomenon, but it's fun to do it yourself if you can. So,
in 1950, you had a paper with Melvin Kalman.
Oh, yeah.
And was that... You mentioned DNA once before, but I'm looking when...
That was not DNA, of course.
No, but
that was a protein.
Was this... I'm looking for your introduction, your movement into biological molecules.
I've been exposures to it several places. I mentioned that Kurt Stern had his laboratory with a centrifuge working on DNA right next to mine in Brooklyn. And at Berkeley, I became acquainted socially with... fellow working on Calvin's project, a fellow named Walter Dandlicker, who was essentially a postdoc at the time. I think his wife was a schoolmate of the wife of one of the assistant professors in the department, Gwynn. who was a spectroscopist. And Gwynn and I shared teaching physical chemistry laboratory courses, and also they lived a few houses away from us in Berkeley. So we got to see a lot of them and Daniliker socially. And Daniliker was working on this project for Cal, and I think that's how I got involved in it.
And what was your portion of that? It was physical properties of...
It was the light scattering.
Okay, you did the light
scattering. I did the light scattering, yeah. They did the ultracentrifuge. They had the first SpinCo ultracentrifuge, the first, literally, instrument number one.
Mm. Where was that made?
That was made in SpinCo, which was where it is now, pretty much, over in Palo Alto. I remember driving over with Daniliker to see it when I was in the building stage. We drove over in a university car, a pre-war car, which his engine kept missing all the way over. We didn't know we were going to get there or not. That was probably in 47. So that was a protein. Well, anyway, I'd always been interested in biology, just as an intellectual interest. As a kid, I collected snakes, and I told you my father was interested in geology, and we collected fossils. Worked one summer when I was in high school. I worked one summer as a to help with a research project that a professor at Columbia Medical School, who lived in Woodstock, was running. He had gotten some money from a foundation to do this project. It was a psychology project. It had to do with asymmetry in the nervous system. And what it amounted to was to look for asymmetry in people's reactions to startling stimuli. So we had various psychology-type black box things, flashing lights and stuff, and noises, and we go around getting volunteers in the community to expose themselves to these things, and then we tell them we were doing various other things. What we're really looking for is to see whether they use their left eye or the right eye, whether they turn left or turn right. Anyway, so I was always kind of interested in biological things. I think I got paid 75 cents an hour for that project. Maybe it was 75 cents a day, I don't remember now.
Did you ever meet Calvin at that time? His name's on the paper.
Oh yeah. Well, even before getting to Berkeley, I met Calvin at American Chemical Society. I guess he was probably looking me over as a new faculty member. So, yeah. Everybody at Berkeley knew everybody else in the department.
I was going to ask you what Berkeley was like when you arrived there as a new
faculty. Well, it was a very friendly place. G.N. Lewis had died just the year before, but his influence was still very strong around the place. That was a tremendous esprit de corps, and as I say, it was very friendly. There was no business of somebody being above somebody else or somebody standing on dignity. Everybody was always glad to talk about whatever you're interested in. So I very quickly got to know a lot of people, including Calvin.
What were the facilities like at that time?
As far as I was concerned, they weren't very much. A lab bench and usual electricity and gas and water. And I had to build things up, so I made several osmometers to start with, and I started building my light scattering apparatus and got some glassware from the stockroom to polymerize polymers in, and went out and bought a couple of fish tanks for thermostat baths, and that's the sort of thing. I remember having to put in my proposed research expenditures for 1 year at one point. I put down $200 for the apparatus I thought I might need during that year, which consisted of things of this kind.
And while you were there for 6 years, did you get any external support then for your work?
At the very end, the ONR started up, and I got a grant from ONR, Office of Naval Research.
What about consulting? Did you do any consulting during that period?
Very little. I think probably, yeah, I remember going to Dow Chemical Company in Midland, Michigan once. May have been a couple other things, but there didn't amount to much, if so.
Would that have been on light scattering work as well?
Yeah.
Were they doing any of that?
They were,
of course,
yeah.
Alfrey was there by that time.
No, that was before Alfrey was there, and this was when Boyer was, it was Boyer I actually went to see, Ray Boyer. And it was on light scattering. I remember they were doing light scattering. It wasn't working very well, and they wanted me to come in and see what I could see about it. My recollection is mainly that the solutions they were using were dirty.
Also during this time, we had mentioned this earlier, but you had in that article, derby hat theory that Mayer had, which around this time, I guess you came back to it and did some more experiments. You and Doty, I think, had tried something much earlier, hadn't you?
At Macmillan. That was the thing which we were doing when Doty heard about the Dubai experiments. We were looking for the derby hat in Macmillan's critical solutions of triethylamine and water. And we didn't find anything much that looked like it. So we didn't quite know what to make of that and didn't do anything with it. And then the Dubai stuff came along anyway. So when I got my apparatus working well at Berkeley, I think somebody organized a symposium on the critical point for the American Chemical Society, and I was invited to participate in it, so I set to work. I think the talk was to be at the end of the summer, and I set to work during the summer to make as many measurements as I could. And that was some of the early, I may should say rigorous, perhaps light scattering from critical solutions. But, I had really one of the first quantitatively accurate apparatuses.
Mm-hmm. And then how did Mayer react to this?
He was very generous. It must have been an unpleasant thing, I think, for him to find that experiments didn't show any critical point, any derby hat phenomenon. On the other hand, the experiments did show there wasn't a classical van der Waals critical point either. It was something more complicated, so I think he found that interesting, but I'm sure he must have been disappointed that a derby hat didn't appear. But he was very generous about it. There was no suggestion of his being bitter or anything. I suppose the fact that I was one of his students probably helped.
Mm-hmm. Around the same time, around 1950, I think, did you spend a year at Harvard?
Yeah, 50-51. I was a visiting lecturer there. Kistiakovsky had a sabbatical, and when somebody went sabbatical, they would bring in somebody to teach his classes for that year, so that was I that year.
I see. How did that arrangement come about? Had you been looking for something?
No, I hadn't been looking. I don't know how it came about. I guess I got a letter in the mail asking if I'd be interested in doing it. They were looking for somebody in a year or two previous, and they were interviewing people, and they interviewed Doty, and they interviewed me, among other people. Well, Doty actually got the job, and he went there. And I guess probably, that was only a couple years before, they probably remembered that when it came to finding somebody to substitute for Kistiakovsky. So I guess they probably got either a letter or a phone call asking me if I'd be interested in doing it.
Did you do any research while you were there?
Yeah, I did some theoretical work on the critical point, actually, and also wrote up some of our other previous work.
Was there any other benefit that accrued from your spending that year at Harvard?
I of course made a lot of new friends, which is always a benefit. Kistiakovsky, Ebright Wilson, various other people at Harvard, to a lesser degree, and to get the chronology right here, actually. I'd gone to General Electric labs for a month during the previous summer to going to Harvard. And
I noticed there was an overlap in those dates.
Yeah, right. And that was a get acquainted month, essentially. Their interviewers had come out. I had actually interviewed for a job at GE about the time, just after I'd gone to Brooklyn, that not being a permanent job. So we were acquainted. At that point, I met Langmuir, actually. Made much more of a contact with Ray Fuas at GE. He was a consultant at Brooklyn. He came down there quite frequently. So I made a good acquaintance with him. Then the GE interviews came out to Berkeley in 1950. I was not entirely happy with the situation at Berkeley as it was developing. Looked like there was going to be more and more work and less and less play as time went on. So I talked to
him. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Berkeley was very nice for a beginning instructor. They left you pretty much alone, do your research, and teach your course, whatever it was, and didn't have to do much of anything else. So the courses took some time, but not excessive, and you had a lot of time. Then as time went on, you got more and more into the workings of the department, and that meant you had more and more things to do. You got on committees. I remember I got on a committee planning a new building. And I could see where this was leading to. None of the older faculty at Berkeley hardly were involved with the research themselves. Directly, they all had their graduate students doing it. And that was not what I particularly wanted to do. So I was interested in exploring alternatives. And that's why I talked to the GE people. So they said, why don't you come around next summer and let's get acquainted. So I did, before going to Harvard. I think the Harvard thing developed about the same time. So I went to GE for a summer, for a month, and then went to Harvard for the year, and during the course of the year was offered the job at GE and took it and went back there following, instead of going back to Berkeley.
Move, well, how did you react to the move from academia to industry? Had you done that purposely, or was it just that the GE people were there and you had been talking to them?
Well, when I went and saw the GE atmosphere during that summer, actually I had seen it once on the interview trip before. It looked very interesting. It was a very, unrestricted type atmosphere, and of course very good facilities. If you had an interesting project to work on, I mean, if you could find an interesting project to work on, usually they'd let you do it. So in that respect, it wasn't hardly any different from academia. But you could spend much more time on your research. And in place of having to teach a course and serve on committees, once in a while they'd come around to you with some particular problem that needed immediate work on, and that was the way you sort of paid your way. So at that time, when I was there, it was a very good place for doing that kind of research. For a while after that, it got much more applied. Now I think it's gotten back more toward the fundamental type of work. it was rather unusual industrial laboratory in that respect.
This was in Schenectady?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What kind of administrative arrangement did they have in the lab?
Oh, they had, I guess, much the usual kind of thing, starting at the top there as a vice president and director of research. Then they divided the lab into, I think, five departments, of which chemistry was one, and there was a director. And the chemistry department was divided into several sections, one of which was physical chemistry, and that was the one I was in. That had some 15, something like that, people in, with a manager who was busy all the time going to meetings, and the rest of us were down there at the bench, and we could put all our time in on the science.
You remember who the manager was?
Yeah, the physical chemistry manager was a fellow named Herman Liebhafsky. Lieb, L-I-E-B-H-A-F-S-K-Y. He had been actually a Berkeley graduate of PhD some years before. The chemistry manager was Abraham Lincoln Marshall. That was Liebhafsky's superior, Abraham Lincoln Marshall. And the laboratory director was C. Guy Suits, C. Guy, G-Y, Suits, S-U-I. Yes, who was an applied physicist, had some 50 patents, I think, to his name. They were a good group of people. Marshall was somewhat hard to get along with personally. Some people found him very difficult. I never had any problems. But, some people found it hard to know what he was thinking, and I guess that it was hard to know what he was thinking, but most of his thinking seemed to be good thoughts when it came out.
What about others in your group?
At GE? I shared a laboratory with several people. All the time I was there, it was with Fraser P. Price. We all worked on polymers. And for a while, there were other people who came and went. The first one was John Hoffman, who is now at Midland, director of the Midland Institute.
I met him about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, did you? Uh-huh. Well, he hasn't changed much.
Okay.
Julian Gibbs was there for a while. Julian became president of Amherst last. And then there was Ralph Kilb, whom I collaborated with on a paper, K-I-L-B. It's now in Santa Barbara. He's not working for GE anymore. He's working with some nuclear chemistry outfit, I think.